Welcome to the Narrators Podcast for October. This month's show was actually guest hosted and curated by Robert Rutherford, who chose the theme of Something I've Lost, and he also chose all of the performers. Although Robert hosted the show, I'm going to do the introductions for the podcast because I jumbled the order up somewhat and some of the introductions wouldn't make sense the way they were at the show. So that explains why I am doing these introductions instead of Robert. So, without any further chatting on my part, let's get into the show, starting with Robert Rutherford, your host.
Good evening. So, the one thing I've lost probably more than anything are fights. I did a lot of that when I was younger, and, you know, of course, there's a bully in a lot of people's story, you know, and in my case, of course, it was like the fat kid who lived across the street who smelled like sour milk and paternal abuse. His name was Jesse, and he was a really horrible, horrible person, and he sat on me a lot, and I was a little fella. Still kind of am, but I was much littler. And he tortured me and would poke on my chest, and he sat on me a lot, and he didn't like that I called him Jesse the Hutt. So that was kind of my big first taste of patterned violence. And but most of the fights that I've lost have actually, and the ones that have taught me are the ones that have come as a surprise by generally people who are much younger and smaller than me. And I have a good story about, I moved a lot around a lot, military, so I lived on a lot of barracks and had one kid next door, Tyrone, who I really liked. He was a few years younger than me, just a tiny little guy. And I was trying to recruit him to play Krull because I had a great Nerf boomerang, and I don't know if anybody here knows Krull, but it's not a good movie. But I loved it when I was a kid, and I had a... Anyways, I was recruiting him to play with me, but he wanted to play the lead role and have the boomerang, and we got into a little scuffle that escalated, and I pushed him, and I expected, you know, that there would be, you know, 10 or 15 minutes of pushing, maybe some swearing, and... he kind of eschewed the need for that just by dealing me a very swift roundhouse kick to the face, and my lip went over my teeth and stayed there, and my teeth were showing through my lip. So that kind of ended that fight really quickly, and that was a big point of shame for me that I carried for a long time. And of course, there's plenty of there's other stories like that, but I think the fights that I lost most of were the fights with my sisters, and I have three of them, and they were pretty relentless. It started with my older sister, Shannon, pretty early on. We would bathe together, and I did something in the tub one day to upset her, and she threw a giraffe brush at me, and that went through my upper lip and all the way, and my mom came into the bathroom, and I was shaking my head, and the giraffe brush was hitting me on the sides of the head, and she pulled it out, and you could see my teeth, and it wasn't that bad. Lips heal quickly. We were really poor, so she didn't want to take me to the doctor, so she just put a butterfly bandage over it, and she called me Little Hitler for several days. So that's kind of how it started, but then as soon as their numbers expanded, my sisters... They ran our house like a prison gang, and I was kind of like the outsider. I was somebody who had done, like, I was a cop or a narc, and I was in the brig with my sisters. And my younger sister, who is 6 years younger than me, she has all of these early memories of being 2, 3 years old, and my other two sisters, my older sister, is pinning me down, and she just remembers hitting me in the face with her diaper nonstop or jumping on my chest, and... And those are really pleasant memories for her. And it just got worse from there. And my sisters would strip me naked and lock me out of the house. And they were grapplers. They were really good at grappling and holding me. And so I got to be a really good wrestler. through all of this. I never used it, really, but to get out of from under them. And as we aged, it just got more intense. And my sisters, once they hit the age, you know, between the ages of like 12 and 15, they got really relentless. And I remember the first time, you know, because of course you're not supposed to hit girls and all of that. So I really refrained from it. And most of what we did was grappling and slapping and some scratching. And my mother generally would just kind of stay out of it unless we started swearing. And then she'd be like, hey, she'd look up from a crossword and be like, uh-uh. But if it was, you know, if we were just wrestling, it was fine. But I remember the day that I hit my sister with a fist and how that changed the game. Because, and I just kind of did it tentatively. We were in her bedroom. I think I was trying to borrow her hairspray, and she wasn't going to let me do that, so it got heated. But she got into grapple position, and I threw a tentative fist at her, and it connected. And then I got this look like, okay, it's on. This is a new era. And she proceeded to beat the shit out of me. And it was on. I had bruises. It was nothing. And then from then on, it was like 3 years of warfare. And it was bloodied knuckles. There was one time we were in the kitchen, and she pulled me down from one of these. And my head jerked back, and there was blood on the ceiling. And my mother was really upset about that. It was awesome. But it taught me a lot about gender equity, about equality, and about how to lose gracefully. And now, you know, I'm not afraid of women, which is great because I've been losing to them my whole life. So, fights.
That was Robert Rutherford. Our next storyteller is a life coach operating in Denver, Colorado. This is Don Greeny.
So I lost my brother about a decade ago and gained a sister at the same time. That's right, my brother had a sex change operation. My brother is now my sister. Years before he officially became a female, we lived in California. He was going to college in San Diego. When he confided in me that he was transgendered, I realized at the time that he didn't tell me because we share these kind of details with each other. We were never that close, but because he wanted to see my shocked reaction. He was giddy with anticipation when he told me, but I'm somebody who can suffocate a person with follow-up questions, and I went into that mode automatically without giving him the pleasure of a stunned reaction. What does that mean? I asked. What's the difference between that and a transsexual? Can't you just wear a dress when you wake up feeling like a girl and pants when you feel like a boy? Not only was he completely deflated, but he also shoved me over there with all those other people who didn't get it and who were the reason he couldn't go public. He lamented that nobody understood, and woe is me, and aren't I someone to feel sorry for? I made him cry, and I think he was expecting to make me cry. A while after that, he moved to San Francisco without telling anyone. My parents didn't know where he went, let alone what gender he now wanted to be known as. For years, they didn't know if he was alive or dead. I was the only one who knew where he was. He'd send emails to let me know how hard it was to be her. Homeless at times, sleeping in the car, getting beat up. Instead of displaying an approved amount of empathy, I would inevitably tell him that he needed to tell my parents that he's alive. He didn't have to tell them about the gender thing, but just let them know where he was. But he was adamant about never denying who he really was ever again, and he was convinced that my mom and dad would react in a hurtful way if he told them the truth. So this went on for several years. I would get random emails about his news, and I would field inquiries from my parents and grandparents about what happened to him. I refused to tell them what I knew, mainly because it wasn't my responsibility, but I also felt like it would give him an easy out. In fact, I believed he secretly wanted me to tell everyone so that he wouldn't have to be confronted with their reactions. We would always fight about that. I didn't think it was right that he denied them the ability to react at all because he was scared of that it was going to be negative. When he finally got the operation, and I'm assuming it was because he was newly filled with touchy-feely girly hormones, she wrote a letter to my parents and was thrilled that they responded so positively. They told her that it was going to take some time, but they were happy to know she was still alive, and they promptly sent her money for a dire dental procedure. Of course, I issued a silent told you so and kissed half of my inheritance goodbye. The kicker was that my mom was pissed at me. She couldn't understand that it wasn't my responsibility, and shouldn't she direct her anger at the person who refused to communicate to her for so many years? It was then that I realized that my mom finally had the daughter she's always wanted. They soon were talking on the phone a lot, and although they fought often, they became closer than when they were when my sister was my brother. My brother and I were never close, and my sister and I are even more distant. I suppose the whole situation would have had more of an impact on me if we were closer. I don't really care about the whole transgender thing. It doesn't really affect me. But what I found annoying was the difficulty I was having with pronouns. I haven't seen my brother in over 2 decades, and I haven't seen my sister ever, so my brain is not accustomed to the change. It's been less confusing for me just to use he, since he was now my brother for almost 30 years, or was my brother for almost 30 years, and that wouldn't change no matter what gender he is now. But during the years of drama, I found it hard to answer the question, do you have any brothers or sisters, without first looking like a deer in headlights. Yes, it would be easier for me just to say, I have a sister, but I could envision me answering the next question with, he's a year and a half older. So my standard answer is still, I have a brother who's now my sister, and that seems to do a good job of preparing them for any pronoun stumbling we're about to encounter. My mom still uses he as well, but sometimes I correct her, or she corrects herself, and we try to insert she in the same conversation, and it just gets ridiculous. I've never been so caught up on pronouns before. When I would update my friends about what was going on throughout this whole thing, I found that I would be very logical about my pronoun usage, using he for anything pre-operation and she for anything post-operation. But the confusion came when I would weave back and forth from current to past, finding myself using both pronouns to refer to one person. So to cut down on having to use any pronouns at all, I started making up words like Brister, which aptly described him as a girl not yet having the parts to be officially called a girl, and also brother slash sister, he, she, and him, her, all as single words. Not only did these faux words eliminate the need for pronouns and help us understand who we were referring to at any given time, they also made me and my friends giggle. It was hard not to have fun with how much confusion I was having with pronouns in any given conversation. It's fun to think of how I've been affected by my brother's dramatic gender switch, like I'm the one traumatized, and I'm the one who's the most inconvenienced. And it's fun for me to remember when I first moved to Denver and responded to a Roommate Wanted ad. I was being interviewed by a girl who lived in the house, and after talking for a while, she lowered her voice and got serious, saying, "I think I should probably tell you that I'm a lesbian." To which, of course, I exclaimed, "Oh my God, so is my brother." So anyway, I thought this story was going to be about losing my brother to a sex change operation, but instead, I realized I've completely lost my ability to take pronouns for granted.
That was Don Greeny. Your next storyteller is a fixture in the rock and roll scene in Denver, Colorado. He owns several clubs all over town. This is Jim Norris.
All right, well, thanks, Robert, for everything, you know. I feel a little outclassed and a little humbled to be here, that's for sure. So, you know, unlike lots of people, I've lost lots of things. You know, I've lost keys, wallets, drugs, bets. And like lots of people, I've lost a lot of friends, family, and pets. I've lost at businesses and at marriage and many other things, but there's always ends up being kind of a sense of balance to everything I get. You know, what I've lost, I've gained something back. And now that I'm solid in my 40s, and I regret to say that, I truly do, so, but perpetually, you know, I'm remarkably immature for my age. But now that I'm in my 40s, sometimes I feel I just kind of just lost my way a bit. You know, I know it's trite, but when I went to college, I went there to be a writer. You know, I wanted to write the great American novel and die drunk and tragic by 42, and I've done none of those things. My last class for my degree was a writing workshop with maybe 15 other writing major seniors. We had to keep a journal for the whole semester and fill it with anything, and I gave that journal my all. I dug deeper into my heart and soul than I'd have ever gone in search of the words that just maybe might make me a writer. It was, without a doubt, the most effort I'd put to anything in my entire academic career. The night before the last class, a buddy and I decided to get a hotel room to party and blow off some steam. All I had to do the next day was read from my journal and turn it in. I would be done with college forever. So we ate a bunch of mushrooms, drank beer, and listened to tunes for a few hours in this hotel room. After a while, we turned on the TV, and it just happened to be the night of the L.A. riots. And they'd been going on for probably 2 or 3 hours, and we were both transfixed by all of it. You know, it was horrible, surreal, and, you know, so far away from where I was in Greeley, Colorado. You know, if anybody's been there, it's a isolated, smelly hole. So I busted out my journal and filled the last 20 pages with pure fucking gold. I'm telling you, I was on fire. Beer, mushrooms, and the, you know, goddamn history being played out on CNN right in front of me. It was perfect, you know, for, you know, it was a perfect moment for a writer. So we stayed up all night talking and watching the show, and I was writing. So when I showed up for class the next day, I was still feeling a little heavy, you know. And when it was my time to read, I busted out like the last 10 pages of what I'd written the night before and just read that. And I tell you, it floored the class. And I'm not just tooting my own horn. You know, rarely in times of my life have I written anything that moved anybody. But I could tell, you know, the class really dug it. And as I left the class, we all turned in our journals, and mine was this sweet 200-page Guatemalan-covered thing. I used to have long hair and be into the dead and all that kind of stuff. And young and ideal before I went back to punk rock. So I turned that in with a stack of all the other, you know, the 15 other journals, and I ended up staying around the campus for another, you know, I stayed around campus for graduation and then stayed for a few days after that so I could get that journal back, and then that was going to be the basis for my entire writing career, or so I thought. Well, the teacher called me a couple days after graduation and said that he never received the fucking journal. But he knew I'd done it, so he was going to pass me in the class. You know? So the professor lost it. 200 pages of irreplaceable dreams, sorrows, reflections, and once-in-a-lifetime moments, just like that riot. It was fucking devastating. It was absolutely devastating. But I had already planned this giant, you know, I'd sold all my stuff and moved everything into my truck, and I was planning on living out of my truck for the next year. So I went and bought a new journal, lived in my car for a year, you know, hid out in a cabin for a while so I couldn't take the cold anymore. Did zines, hopped trains, had an amazing son. And then I got a job in rock and roll where insane becomes routine, you know. And when I first started, you know, Robert's girl, Mary, she gave me a job there. And I'd take notes every day, you know, when I started. Wow, this is unbelievable. This guy, like, you know, he was so drunk he threw up in the bathroom. Then the next day it was something even worse and worse and worse. You know, and after, suddenly it's 15 years later and the routine, you know, the insane truly is routine. And I've pretty much just gone balls out in a life to replace all those lost words, those lost thoughts, those lost moments. And in that relentless pursuit to replace those words, I kind of got distracted by life to write them all down. So I appreciate a chance like this to kind of share stuff and maybe get a little focus again in life, you know, find my way again.
That was Jim Norris. Your next storyteller is a guitarist who performed in the band Everything Absent or Distorted. This is Jody Pilmer.
So 7 of my closest friends and I arrived in Manhattan in the spring of 2008 without a place to stay. So we called our New York connection. We had been on probably an ill-advised tour at that point that had taken us through Chicago and Detroit and Pittsburgh, and at this point it was time to take Manhattan. And I would say take Manhattan by storm, but I'm instructed that these are supposed to be true stories, so I'm not going to say that. And so we had played our music to some sparsely populated venues in those 3 previously mentioned cities, and we had stunk up an Econoline van in the way that only 8 guys traveling together for a week with not places to stay in any of the cities that we were going to can by the time we arrived in Manhattan, again, without a place to stay. Our New York connection was Betsy, and Betsy is Andy's sister, Andy being the guy who played accordion and banjo in the band. And Betsy lives in Williamsburg or Brooklyn or, you know, one of those places that you love to visit but you can't really live there because you're not cool like Betsy. And Betsy hooked us up with Toshi. Toshi was in the movies. He was the guy who played the mad Asian gangster in that movie, The Departed, with Leonardo DiCaprio. And if you think back to the scene with the really mad Asian gangster in that movie, I think you'll be able to picture who Toshi was. At this point, Toshi is the person who separates me by only 2 degrees from Jack Nicholson. So, Toshi was also some sort of Brooklyn party boy. And he, from all outward appearances, he liked to host parties, and he liked to surround himself with these sort of paid lady servants. And they called themselves Toshettes. At one point, and I'm not making that up. At one point, one of the Toshettes even introduced herself to us as an intern, which I honestly still don't know what that means. Toshi's one of those people that I could honestly sit here and probably tell stories about all evening. We only spent a couple of days with him. But for purposes of this story, the really important thing about Toshi is he allowed us to stay in his immaculately furnished 3-story loft in Williamsburg on blow-up mattresses that the Toshettes would air up every night and set out for us and then take down as soon as we left in the morning. And we paid, it was like $25 a head each night for the 8 of us. And that's where we stayed. And we would wake up, this was the place where we were essentially crashing was Toshi's home base. And so every morning when we would wake up, it would be like 6:30 in the morning, and there would be a housekeeper who was meticulously scraping out the ashes and cleaning the, essentially it was like this big hanging wood-burning stove that hung down from the 20-foot ceiling in the middle of the living area. And so she started doing that like at 7 o'clock every morning. But we'd also wake up to Toshi and the Toshettes making phone calls and faxing people. I can still only imagine what sort of information was being like traded by Toshi and with Toshi and his staff. And so Toshi was actually a pretty normal-looking guy, but he evoked the image of some sort of backroom porn king. And to this day, every time I think of Toshi, I picture him in like a long white silk robe with polka dot boy shorts on. Even though I never saw him in anything even close to that. It's just like the image that he sort of had out there at all times. And for the last thing on Toshi, some perspective. The bathroom in this incredible loft had a window that was probably about 4 feet tall, right at eye level, about a foot wide, and it looked into the shower from the living room that it was adjacent to. So in other words, anybody in the living room could look into the shower and see what was going on in the shower. And so when we asked Toshi about it, he very nonchalantly explained that he liked to host a lot of parties, right? And sometimes at those parties, women wanted to take a shower. Makes sense, right? Obviously. This is where we stayed while we were in Manhattan. This was actually in Brooklyn. But this whole time during the trip, I had been carrying with me for these 6 or 7 days this messenger bag, and it had my high value personal items in it: an iPod, my work cell phone, since I was doing all sorts of business while we were on this sort of make believe rock and roll tour, and it had this journal, travel journal, that I had been sort of sporadically writing in throughout the trip. And a couple of other things. And it was just a black messenger bag. And it was sort of like, it became this crutch for me because I was so worried that I would lose it or somebody would steal it. And so the night for the big show in Manhattan came. And again, Betsy had hooked us up. We were playing a birthday party for Jesse Malin at his bar in on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. If you don't know who Jesse Malin is, you're like me at that time. But I can assure you that he's really cool, apparently. And we were playing this show. And so we pile into our Econoline van. We drive from, Toshi Paradise in Williamsburg across the bridge and into Manhattan. We set up. We do our sound check. We play a show. It was super fun, as it always is. I'm sure I thought we sounded terrible, which I often did, and sometimes I was wrong. And so we played the show, and the other thing that we did was we got really, really drunk, which was an underlying theme throughout this entire tour. And I didn't do it every night, but that night was one of my big ones, that night in Chicago, which is a whole other story. But anyway, so sometime in probably around the end of the middle of the night, we start clearing our gear out, and I realized that what I had avoided for the whole trip had happened. Somebody stole my man purse. And I was devastated, and my devastation was magnified by my drunkenness, and it was magnified by the weak emotional state that I was in after 7 days in a car with seven of my closest friends, which you would think is great, maybe, but it weakens your emotional state. I'll tell you that right now. And so I spent the rest of the night circling the bar and checking and rechecking every place that I saw that bag, every place that I thought I had set it. And I started suspiciously watching every person that walked out of the bar, wondering if the bag that they were carrying was mine. It always wasn't. It was always a purse. And it didn't look anything like my bag. And when I wasn't checking for my bag, I was talking to people about it. I was lamenting the loss of this bag. It went something like, somebody stole my bag. It's got my journal in it. If I could just get the journal back, that's what's important. All these memories. And I had that conversation probably 40 times that night with people, with my dear friends who would listen and mostly act sympathetic as a result of it. Finally, it occurred to me that I had been going about it all wrong, and I remembered that my work cell phone was in the bag. And so I developed a plan to outsmart the thief, call him or her up on my work cell phone, trick them into telling me who they were, where the bag was, whatever. I was gonna get my bag back doing that. So I walk out onto the sidewalk on the Lower East Side, probably lit a cigarette because I thought I was smoking at that time, and I pull out my personal cell phone because I had two cell phones on this trip, which I needed. Pull out my personal cell phone. I dial up my work cell phone number, and after a couple of rings, a woman answers. And I say, "Who is this?" And she says, "Well, who is this?" And I say, "Well, you stole my bag. Who is this?" And she says, "I don't know what you're talking about. Who is this?" And I'm like, "But you're talking to me on the phone that was in my bag, so who is this?" And it goes on for like 3 minutes of this. It just ridiculous drunken accusations being hurled at her by me, until finally I realized that this liar on the other end of the phone is not going to confess. She's not going to tell me where she is so I can come get my bag or send the police to get it, and I'm basically out of luck and my plan's been foiled. So I drop it. I essentially chalk it up to a ruined evening. It was probably the most fun night that we spent on that tour, and I ruined it by obsessing about this bag and all these dubiously important things that were contained in it. And at that point, I was resigned to the fact that I had lost this bag. And I don't remember how we got back to Toshi's that night. It's probably not important. But when we got back, I learned that part of the deal at Toshi's Palace is when you return from an evening on the town, you're greeted with a bunch of lit candles and some really nice down-tempo music playing over the sound system, dimmed lighting. All your beds are meticulously laid out by the Toshettes. Very comfortable. I would highly recommend Toshi's. And I have his number, actually, if anybody wants it after the show. And I think we probably spent the rest of the night or the next hour or so debating, because the music, the soft music was playing, and we ended up debating whether Morcheeba's first record or Massive Attack's second record was best. And I still don't have an answer to that question, in case you're wondering. And I would be happy to debate it with anybody after the show. I woke up the next morning, and I saw in the corner of the room, right where I had put it, in order to make sure that nobody would steal it, my man purse, with all of its really important contents still in it. And I realized what had occurred. I grabbed my personal cell phone, and I flipped it open, and I looked at the number I had called, and I realized that I was one digit off. And I had called some poor person in Colorado at probably about 11:30 at night, and I felt like a fool. And for the next couple of weeks, I sort of went back and forth on the issue of whether or not I should call this poor woman that I had ear punched and apologize. And I didn't do it, and I still feel bad about that.
That was Jody Pilmer. Your next storyteller is me, Andrew Orvidal.
So when Robert told me the theme was something I've lost, I immediately thought of it in the sense of contests, which I've lost a lot of. I'm like not a winner. If there's a choice between winning and losing at something, I generally lose at something. I have like a ton of like second place holdings, which if you get second place in something, you can consider that you did, that you performed well. You know, you could be like, well, I did well, but you can never pretend that you won. You can't, you know, you can never convince yourself or anyone else, obviously, that you won. There's actually this like terrible t-shirt, I think it might be a bumper sticker too, that you see on terrible people that says, second place is the first loser. Actually, you probably read in your head like this, second place is the first loser. Because that's like how it translates when you read it. And I hate that shirt so much, but when you think about it, it is true. And especially when you receive second place at something, you're uniquely aware of that fact. You're like, I was the first person to not win at this. So I've lost so many contests, but I can remember the first thing I ever won. I was 8 years old, I was in Cub Scouts, and I won the Pinewood Derby. And if you don't know what the Pinewood Derby event is, it's for Cub Scouts to do. Someone's cheering in the back. Someone else just got to relive their glory moment. Pinewood Derby is where you're given a block of wood and wheels and an axle, and you have to craft a little car that you race down a short stretch of track. That's all you do. However, my father is an aeronautical engineer, so we, and by that I mean he, crafted the most amazing Pinewood Derby car that's probably ever been seen in a Cub Scout race. It didn't like look like anything fancy. It was just sort of like a smooth like wood shape, but it destroyed. It destroyed every other car. And if that sounds like I'm bragging, I am 100% bragging, because I don't get to brag about that many things. This was a 100% win. It destroyed. In fact, the only thing I contributed to it was the paint job. I got to choose the colors. My dad pretty much did everything else. But I was given a little medal when you win. It's not like a ribbon for your wall. It's a medal. And it's like a little, you know, like a military medal. It's like a little swatch of fabric. It was blue and yellow with a gold medal on it. It had a picture of a race car, like leaves on the side. For a Cub Scout, it's like the Medal of Honor, pretty much. You wear that on your uniform. You're highly decorated when you go to den meetings or whatever they were called. And I loved that medal, and I loved feeling like I won something. Like, that felt great. And then the loss I was going to tell you about when I remembered the story was the loss the following year when I decided I would be the project head on this year's Pinewood Derby, and we were going with the aesthetic choice of the DeLorean from Back to the Future, which my dad informed me that we would have no chance of winning if we crafted the DeLorean from Back to the Future, but I didn't care. I was like, dude, we're going to do it. And it did look like the DeLorean, and it performed terribly. And that was what I thought. I was like, oh, well, that's a funny way to lose when you could like just keep winning. Me and my dad could have gone on forever, or like 3 years, or however long you can be in Cub Scouts. We could have destroyed. But I realized at some point when I was remembering that medal that somewhere along the way I've lost that medal. It used to be like my most prized possession. It's the only thing I've ever won. I've won some other things. I'd be lying if I said I didn't. But I won like contests, but I've never won I'd never a tangible proof of winning. Like, be like, oh, you didn't know that I won? Well, here's a medal that proves that I won. And somehow I lost it. It went from like being like prominently displayed in my room to being kept in like a little like stash box of like important items. And then it was inevitably probably put in like a cardboard box that I stored in my mom's garage when I moved away or something. And at some point, she was probably like, I need you to look through these boxes of old toys and stuff he left. And I was like, whatever, give them to Goodwill or something. And so that medal is gone. And I just realized that. I was like, oh, well, maybe I still have it. And I realized I don't have it. It's gone. I somehow managed to lose the only actual thing I've ever won. Like, I still managed to lose that, like, symbol. And as I was remembering it, I was like, I wish I still had that. Like, it would be cool to, like, look at. It sounds cheesy. You'd be like, oh, really? You want to look at, like, a medal you won when you were 8? But yeah, I would like to look at a medal that I won when I was 8. I'd like to, like, take it out and be like, I remember this. Like, me and my dad, you know, we kicked ass at the racetrack for one evening together. And yeah, I wish I did still have it.
That was me. Your next storyteller is a favorite on the narrator's show. She's also a playwright. This is Ellen Graham.
The day my son was born dawned gray and cold with a powdery snow sifting down. When I woke up to a curious flood of fluid, it didn't occur to me that my water might be breaking. That was supposed to be dramatic, like how it happened to my cousin Sandra, whose water broke in an unambiguous tsunami while she was at a bowling alley in Raton, New Mexico. Luckily, it was the 80s, and she could disguise her drenched clothes underneath an ankle-length denim duster coat. For me, it wasn't so dramatic, and I wandered around the house, perplexed, the cat tangling anxiously around my feet, until finally I called to the hospital, confirmed we should go in. I woke my sleeping spouse. I think something's happening. At the hospital, we were subjected to a lengthy check-in process with a weary woman who seemed like a former probation officer. As I baptized the upholstery of the beige side chair with a steady drip of amniotic fluid, we waived the hospital of all liability and made a $1,500 down payment on our firstborn child. We checked into our room. My parents arrived. I played Scrabble with my mother, and the powdery snow sifted down outside the window. After a few hours, a nurse checked my progress. Apparently, a certain number of hours after the water breaks, the risk of infection grows, but I wasn't progressing fast enough. So she gave me some Pitocin to speed things up a little. A drug in the vein and the contraction started to come abnormally fast and close. The Scrabble game was abandoned, and a few minutes later, I started throat singing. Following instructions from our parenting class at the hospital, my husband and I had dutifully established a code word to use when I was ready for some pain relief. That way, if I was begging and screaming to please give me a fucking epidural, my lucky husband would know I wasn't really serious and would withhold it until I said the proper code word. I will not reveal what the code word was, but suffice it to say it had something to do with Star Trek. Never have I enunciated so clearly. The anesthesiologist was a creepy little gnome who spoke to me in baby talk. It hurts. It hurts. Let's make the hurt go away. It was his day off, and he came in wearing golf clothes. A little weird, given that it was a high of 10 degrees that day. My spouse was disturbed by the doctor's apparent lack of credentials, because could they have just wandered in off the street with a large gauge needle? I didn't care. I just wanted that needle stabbed between my vertebra post haste. A drug in the vein and calm descended. A few pleasant hours passed, and everything, bizarrely, started to fade. The volume hushed. My surroundings lost their pigment like a photograph bleaching and curling on a hot dashboard. Full disclosure, this is the part where my memory splits into a series of fragments and time gets kind of telescoped and shrunken at the same time. And I'm not truly sure how much some of this sequence is correct and how much it conforms to what actually happened. A battalion of nurses moved in, fists clenched, holding sharp instruments and tiny monitors with glowing screens. They moved beneath a halo of honeys and sweeties and don't worries. What was going on? I looked over at my mother, sitting at a remove, stoic, her hands folded, eyes focused on the digital display of my vital signs. I saw the corners of her mouth shift almost imperceptibly down, and I knew I was in trouble. Your blood pressure's a little high, honey. Your blood pressure's a little low, honey. We're going to give you something to... A drug in the vein, and I jolted up out of the bed, racked by tremors. Was it really going to happen? Was the baby going to burst out of my chest, the hinge of his gigantic jaws spilling over with toxic drool? Your blood pressure's a little high, honey. We're going to give you something to... A drug in the vein in the room resolved. And soon it was time to push. The last thing I'd had to eat other than popsicles and ice chips was a piece of toast 14 hours earlier. I felt weak and wired like in my college days when I consumed only vodka and cappuccinos and my trembling muscles would not obey. Push! I did, veins bulging, blood vessels bursting. Push! I pushed, but I felt my body failing like a bicyclist bonking on the ascent. Finally, the doctor had to use a vacuum extractor thing to pull the baby out. His head emerged strangely white, as though hewn out of marble. I don't really remember them giving me the baby, though I have pictures of myself holding him, smiling and weeping. What I really remember are the drugs buzzing in my body as I drank a huge plastic cup of watery fruit punch, and then they whisked him away to the nursery. Why? Couldn't he breathe? The nurses twittered their usual reassurances, and there was a mass exodus from the room, and suddenly I was alone, truly alone, for the first time in 9 months. The room was dark. Outside, the night sky glowed orange and the snow sifted down. Okay. I had to get up. My foggy, slurry brain tried to manipulate the strings of the spastic marionette that was my body. Get up. Somehow I got to the bathroom, wheeling my IV. I don't remember sitting down, but I remember standing up. Gotta get to the nursery. The light changed. Years passed. I grew old. Ellen, I had a sensation of diving through space, smeary stars, galaxies. Was I dead? Ellen, are you okay? Ellen? I opened my eyes. The tiny Latina nurse knelt in front of me, peering up. How had she gotten there? She told me later, I didn't realize how tall you were until you stood up in that bathroom. She loaded me into the wheelchair and took me to the nursery. The boy wriggled underneath the heat lamp. I noted his long and bony hands, deeply lined like mine. I threw up all over the nursery. What had happened to me? I had entered the hospital 5'11", 185, powerful and tight as a drum. I left an amnesiac, hobbled, sutured, puffy like a partially deflated basketball. In the days following the birth, I was happy. I really was, but I kept returning to those disordered scenes at the hospital, worrying at them like you do a loose tooth. I couldn't find a coherent sequence. Did this follow this, or a jumble of discordant pieces? Did I faint first, or when was that picture taken? How long was I alone in that dark room with the snow falling silently outside? Did I imagine the nurse's disgust at me when I fainted and threw up, the doctor's contempt for my inability to push him out on my own? If I only realized my water was breaking, we could have gone to the hospital earlier, and I wouldn't have needed the Pitocin, which would have meant I wouldn't need the epidural, and we would have made it easier to push, which would have meant no vacuum, no vomit, no collapse, no missing the baby's first bath because I was too weak to get out of bed. A few days after we came home from the hospital, I told my sister, I think the doctor thinks I didn't do a good job. She looked at me steadily and said, do you really think that? Yes, I did. Somehow, in the middle of all this, there was a hole, a dark spot, a small but critical detail in the massive painting that refused to come into focus about 15, 20, 25 minutes I'd lost. It was impossible to take it seriously, you know. I told myself, you have a son. He is healthy. He is perfect. He is beautiful. Children die. Mothers die. Parents are deployed. Babies are born into war zones of poverty and illness. You didn't even have a fucking C-section. You are lucky. Shut up. But still... There was this jagged piece I couldn't jam into place. We brought a new person into this world. In theory, I'm the one he should have known the best from riding around with me for 9 months. But who was I in those lost minutes? How did I greet him when he met me for the first time? I was sick, weak, powerless, as I will no doubt be again someday over the course of his life, when I least want and least expect it. I'm an American, so I guess this makes this an American story. And American stories that talk about losing something have to talk also about gaining something of equal or greater value. And of course, my gains far, far outstrip my losses, because I have my boy. But still, still.
Your final storyteller on the show this month runs one of Colorado's coolest venues, the Gothic Theater in Englewood, Colorado, and he performed this really great story for us at the show. This is Kent Shelton.
Over the years, I've had a lot of pets. I've had about, I don't know, 8 cats and 5 dogs, and I'm proud to say I only ever lost one of them. I lost one cat, and to be fair, it was a cat I did not like. I was living on the 5th floor of an apartment building in Chelsea in New York, and I was living there with a woman who I loved and who hated me, and she had a cat that she loved that I hated, and the cat hated us both. It was a horrible cat. It was a stray she had brought in as a kitten. It was this black, skinny cat with a bad haircut. And it really wasn't even like having a cat. It was like you had trapped an angry crow in your apartment. It was, you just couldn't pick it up without it like twisting and biting. And it was just, it was horrible. And one day, it wasn't around anymore. We couldn't find it anywhere in the apartment. It didn't come to the kitchen and make this horrible sound that it usually made when it was hungry. We couldn't find it. And so we were on the 5th floor, we assumed it had gotten out in the hall and maybe somebody had taken it in. I didn't assume it had gone out the 5th story window because there was not a dead cat all over the sidewalk in front of the building. So I, at the lady's insistence, I made a lost cat sign. We made 5 copies of it. And I went and put one in front of the elevator on every floor of the building, which in retrospect is really fucking stupid because I could have put it in the elevator because that's a little room that travels to every floor of the building. But I put up 5 signs. And a couple days went by, 3 or 4 days, and nobody ever contacted us about the cat. And I thought, well, the cat's gone. And so it was, I don't know, it was like 3, 4 days later, I was leaving the apartment about 10 o'clock at night. I was going to go up to the corner store or do something. I was being sent on an errand. And as I walked out of the apartment building, I heard a meow, and I froze. And I heard a meow again. And I looked down in the area where the trash cans are, under the front stoop of the building. And the meow was coming from there. And I went down and moved a couple of trash cans aside. And there was the cat, meowing and alive. And now this is another floor down, so this is 6 floors from that window, and the cat had fallen and was there. And I picked the cat up, and it seemed perfectly normal, except that one of its back legs was kind of like a wind chime made of driftwood that was kind of just spinning around in a really nauseating way. So I hopped in a cab and immediately made out for the only vet you can go to at 11 o'clock in Manhattan, which is the Animal Medical Center on East 62nd Street, about 50 blocks away. And I'm glad that the cat was in shock and probably dehydrated and had a broken leg, because I could actually ride in a cab with it for 50 blocks. Because if I had tried that when the cat was feeling in the pink, I would have gotten out of the cab looking like a red Jackson Pollock painting. And it was a terrible, terrible cat. So I got to the Animal Medical Center, went into the emergency room there, and they immediately grabbed the cat and wheeled it off and started looking at it. And a vet came to me and said, "Well, the cat's in shock. I think the cat has a broken leg. We've sedated the cat, and it's comfortable now. Go back home, and we'll call you tomorrow and let you know what's up with the cat. And I said, it's going to be all right. And they're like, yeah, we sedated the cat. We'll have the vet in the morning take a look at it, and we'll give you a call. And I was like, oh, all right. Well, the next morning, I didn't hear anything. The next afternoon, I went to work. And then about 2 in the afternoon, I got a phone call from the Animal Medical Center on East 62nd Street, and they said, your cat's out of surgery. You can come pick him up anytime you'd like. It's $2,800. And I said, I wouldn't give you 28 fucking cents for this lousy, horrible cat. When I got in a cab and I went back up there and I went in and I was like, I didn't authorize any surgery. I didn't say, this was a free cat. This cat was is a millstone around our neck, this curse of a cat. And now you're going to wipe out my meager savings for this awful cat. And now it's going to be a bionic cat that'll probably never die. So I went in to argue with them. I stood there at the desk where they make you pay all your money to get back something you didn't want. And we argued and we went around and around. And I said, like, I never authorized. And they said, well, here's what it is. And you have to do it. And while we were arguing, in the midst of arguing, all of a sudden, a pair of double doors slam open. And a couple of people come running in. And they're like, Bunny in a coma. And everybody freaks out. Everybody's running around like saying the shit you hear on ER. It's like, stat, Chem 7, CBC, lights. They're like all freaking out and pushing this bunny on in a gurney. And all of a sudden, I've got nobody left to argue with. I'm just standing there. So I start pushing through double doors. I go into a room and it's full of cages, full of miserable-looking dogs. And into another room that's full of like plexiglass cages, full of like spiders with crutches. And I go into another room and it's full of cats in cages. And I look and I'm going, left to right, Dewey Decimal, and I find a cat that looks exactly like mine, except that it is shaved up to its hip. And has like 5,000 pins going through its knee and this giant orthopedic piece of hardware. And I unclasp the cage, put the cat under my coat, and run down the back stairs to an elevator. I get home with the cat, and this giant piece of hardware, but it seems to be okay. It's eating, and it's doing everything it did before. A few months later, all the hair had grown back, but there was still this big thing of pins and stuff on its leg, and I was like, well, I can't go back to the Animal Medical Center. So I found some like weird hippie vet down in Chelsea who was like, no questions asked, just took all the pins out and tried to sell me some like Special K, and the cat was fine. Everything was cool. Then I started getting phone calls from the Animal Medical Center saying, hey, you owe us $2,800 and we're not going to give you your cat back unless you pay it. And I said, well, okay, get the cat ready. I'll be down this afternoon. And I wouldn't go. And they'd call me a couple days later and say, look, we're not going to be able to release your pet until you at least set up a payment plan. And I was like, well, you keep the cat. And this keeps going. They don't know I have the cat. They don't know they've lost the cat, for Christ's sakes. They're just in the billing department, and they think, we're going to get this guy's money. We'll give him his cat back then. Eventually, they turn it over to a collection agency. A guy named Sonny Posada from some collection agency starts calling me every day saying, like, look, you got to start making payments on this cat. And I'm like, hey, I don't have a cat. They took my cat. They never gave me my cat back. And he's just getting more and more confused by this. He's like, look, but they send it into collections. And look, we can get our money somehow. And I was curious about how they would do that, because at that time I was working under the table as a bartender at some crummy Irish bar on the west side. I was getting paid $150 cash every Friday by a guy who wanted to go double or nothing for it on the pool table. I had no bank accounts. I had no insurance. And I was like, what are you going to do? You're going to garnish my wages? I don't have any. Are you going to put a lien on my property? I've got nothing. I was like, and I finally told Sonny Posada, I was like, Sonny, the only way you're going to get your money is if you come down here to West 19th Street and take it from me. That's the only way you're going to get it, because I got nothing you can freeze, no assets you can take. I'm down here. I'm the guy standing on the front stoop with a chainsaw cutting up bill collectors, wearing a hockey mask. You want to come get your money? Come on. And he finally told me, he said, you know what? I think that this debt is uncollectible. And I said, thank you, Sonny. That's what I've been telling you all along. And so he never called me again. And after this big adventure, this big ordeal, I still had the cat. I still had Java, the awful, awful cat. And I still didn't like it anymore. I didn't love it, but there must have been some bonding through this whole adventure. Because I kept the wife 4 more years, and I kept the cat 8 more fucking years. So I guess we got together on something eventually. Thank you, guys.
That does it for our show this month. Look for us in a couple weeks for the Narrator's minicast in October. Until then, thank you for listening.